Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is NPR's executive editor, Edith Chapin. Chapin joined NPR in 2012 as the senior supervising editor of NPR's international desk after a 25-year career with CNN, where she began as an intern and ended her tenure as vice president and deputy bureau chief of the network's Washington Bureau. During her time at CNN, she served as a bureau chief in both New York City and the Midwest bureau chief in Chicago. As managing editor in New York, she directed the network's coverage of the September 11th terrorist attacks. As a field producer, she worked on stories in Baghdad before and after the first Gulf War, the genocide in Rwanda and Bosnia, the election of Nelson Mandela in South Africa, and the U.S. invasion of Panama. She's been a recipient of a Peabody Award for CNN's coverage of Hurricane Katrina, a DuPont Columbia Award for the coverage of the East Asian tsunami that same year. Now at NPR as executive editor, she oversees all network desks and reporters and helps set the agenda for the news division. She's also leading the network's efforts to build a collaborative journalism enterprise between NPR and its member stations through a set of content-focused hubs built around journalistic beats and subject areas. She'll be the featured guest at The Give and Take tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performing Arts Center. She joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Edith Chapin, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and welcome to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me here, and it's a pleasure to be in Tulsa.
Well, I think this is your first time in Tulsa. I think you've been in Oklahoma City when you covered Pat Buchanan. Is
that right? That's right. So that's dating myself, going back to the primaries of 1992. But yes, Mr. Buchanan came to Oklahoma City a couple of times, but campaign didn't seem to take him to Tulsa, at least not when I was covering him. So pleased to be here.
Yeah. Currently, you're the executive editor at NPR News. And of course, from movies and television, we know what managing editors do, at least in Hollywood newsrooms. We know what a city editor does or a foreign editor does. What does an executive editor do at NPR?
In the case of NPR, it means that I am responsible for all the reporters and editors at NPR who cover all the specific subject matters. And so my role really is a bridge between editorial and management. And I think of my day as I start focused on editorial and then leave the nuts and bolts to other people to sort of run and can be consulted on big, thorny, controversial issues. But then it's my job to make sure that all of those people have the resources they need, have the support they need. Sadly, it means a fair number of meetings and a lot of coordination. And I have a second area of responsibility, and that's to try and work with the 260-plus member stations as we all try to build one network together instead of individual stations interacting with NPR, but having stations have the ability to work together to harness resources. So in a nutshell, a little bit of everything is what an executive editor does.
Do you miss the day-to-day of journalism? Because obviously you're consulting with your editorial leaders, but they're doing the day-to-day and they're getting really into the details.
I would say that I have ample taste of it so that I don't feel totally disconnected from my roots. But in fairness, I think we've all worked for managers who got too involved and didn't let people do their job. So I try to remember that we have very capable people, some who know their beats and areas of expertise in much greater detail because they're just immersed into it up to their neck all day long. So sometimes it's helpful for me to come in and ask a question because I'm a little bit removed and yet informed, but I try and add value but stay out of the way, you know, when it gets really crazy busy. On the other hand, when it gets crazy busy, you try and sort of pick up an oar and help row in the right direction. So whatever's needed, you know, that's what I try to do.
Yeah. You also set the overall agenda for what NPR is going to report on. I assume the story of the day takes a lot of the day-to-day, but I assume you're looking at broader trends, maybe taking a deeper look at what's going to maybe happen 3 months from now, 6 months from now?
Certainly it's my job along with a couple of other people's to make sure we do step back and plan, and that whether that means planning for an election or planning for a potential indictment or non-indictment by the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, or, you know, an election in Sweden as we had this past weekend, which is part of a trend of, you know, how well would an ultra-right party do? So yes, you keep an eye on the calendar, but you also try and keep an eye on sort of what enterprise projects can we do that make sense, that really need time and preparation to execute. So it's, yes, it's near vision and medium and longer term vision as well.
We're going to talk more about what you're doing today and what NPR is doing today, tonight at the Give and Take. So I'd like to take us into a little bit of your world. You grew up the child of a Foreign Service officer. I imagine you grew up in a number of different world capitals. How did that influence your career choice of journalism?
Well, it was essential. I sort of landed in journalism completely by accident, but probably, if you look back on it, very deliberately. I grew up surrounded by news and information, and I didn't realize that that was unusual. And I had a father who, you know, sort of downloaded his day in an unclassified way at the dinner table. And, you know, I thought that every 10-year-old knew that if there was a freeze in southern Brazil, that world coffee prices went up. That struck me as incredibly natural and obvious. And certainly I lived in Brazil for 6 years. Daily newspapers, sophisticated, you know, television news was on all the time. And it's not that I was consuming all of it all the time, but I was aware of it and it was in conversation or just sort of natural. Then I moved to, or my family, we moved to Africa, and it was very, very different. It was Ethiopia under the communist regime, and there was very little news. What there was a lot of propaganda, down-down, capitalist, imperialist, Yankee.
Was there a lot of anti-Americanism?
There was considerably, and, you know, I would go to school every day past these enormous billboards of Marx, Lenin, and Engels, and I could doodle a really good replica of Vladimir Lenin, which I think had my parents a little concerned at the time. But, you know, it was a very different thing. And so getting Newsweek once a week, you know, by plane and getting the Herald Tribune from Paris, usually 2 days late, was sort of an event because you couldn't watch. There really wasn't any news to watch. But there was every morning my parents listening on shortwave radio to the Voice of America or the BBC. And then I went to boarding school out of necessity and would go to the library and sort of scan the headlines in the New York Times. And of course, my friends thought that was hilarious that, you know, here's this ninth grader that, you know, wants to keep up with the news. But it was a way of having some tangible connection and awareness of what was going on back home. And I, of course, I always lost in the dorms trying to watch the evening news when everyone else wanted to watch Wheel of Fortune. But it was, you know, that sort of led, and several people sort of suggested that maybe I wanted to pursue a career in journalism. So when it came time to go to college, I looked at Northwestern University, and for a number of reasons, that made sense and it was very attractive to me. So it was a very natural progression. And during the summers while I was in college, I had the chance to be an intern at a couple of different places. And I thought, wow, you know, this is a team sport. I love this. Someone's going to pay me to know what's going on in the world. How great is that? And it's been, I won't say how many decades, but you know, it's been a great ride, and it's a great profession, and it's an opportunity to see the world up close, sometimes very difficult, horrifying moments, but also moments of tremendous joy and great human experience. And we are all connected more so than ever these days. And I'm really glad I chose this profession. And despite its challenges and technological changes and the warp speed that it all gets done now, it's been a fantastic career, and I'm so pleased that I didn't end up in banking.
Well, you joined CNN right after, I guess, graduation, and it's been 25 years there. Started as an intern, moved up to a vice president, basically helping coordinate coverage of the White House and Congress, and spent a fair amount of time on the foreign desk and spending time in the field. And, of course, you were also at a time when CNN was really globally one of the most important news organizations in the world.
I timed it perfectly. I mean, they say timing is everything in life. I mean, I joined early 1987, so it had had its early years, but still hadn't worked out all of the kinks. And it was a place that if you were young, they would sort of throw something at you. And if you didn't drop the ball, you got to do something bigger and, you know, greater. And, you know, at the age of 22, I was covering a Category 5 hurricane, and then I went to cover the invasion of Panama, which I had no business, you know, doing. But, you know, they needed people, and someone later told me that when they saw me get off the plane with a group of my colleagues said, "Who brought their kid here? This is no place for a kid." And then several weeks later, she came up and told the story on herself to me and said, "I'm sorry. You've actually shown that you have a valuable contribution to make." And then, of course, the even more astonishing thing is I ended up in Baghdad in the 30 days before the first Gulf War kicked off. Again, even a couple of years later, CNN would not have sent someone as young and inexperienced as I was. But at the time, they went with the options that they had. And for me, it was a tremendous opportunity. I, of course, was not the senior person. I was the lowest flunky, but it was an amazing experience. And CNN was full of those opportunities because it wasn't until the mid-90s that the merger with Time Warner and that it got much more corporate and sophisticated. And of course, it was the first Gulf War more than anything that really put CNN on the global map.
Were you in Baghdad when the
bombing
began? I had
just left.
You just rotated out.
Right. And because we had a very limited number of visas, and so you had to do a very careful choreography, switching people in so you never had more than six people in country at a time. And it was known that we would rotate out. Essentially, the core group that had done from August up until mid-December, they had rotated in, but they were tired and they wanted a break. So most of us were fresh and new. And the idea was then to send me to corporate headquarters in Atlanta to have someone who had just been on the ground in Baghdad be at headquarters in the event that local knowledge would be useful advising the big picture decisions. I think some people wondered whether, our personnel would be safe, and fortunately, that was not an issue. They had many challenges, but mercifully, there was no kidnapping or there was no needing to, run for their lives.
Who knew that they were going to leave the television, the television wires plugged in so they could...
Well, they were essentially radio wires.
Yeah.
It was a four wire, and that turned out to be a sort of low-tech enterprise that paid off really, really well and was riveting. And it was riveting to have been in the room in Baghdad using that method of communication and then suddenly in Atlanta talking to the team there on the other side until, of course, the communication was cut. So long story short, CNN was fantastic to me. Then I got to go be based overseas again at a very young age. And one opportunity led to another. The place was great to me, and I, have nothing but good experiences and great colleagues. And, I worked very hard, as did all of my colleagues, but it was an extraordinary time.
And an amazing time for CNN as far as being an important news source, both internationally and nationally, which, cable news has changed an awful lot.
Well, and it was fascinating to work for an American news organization that people could see overseas. And so in the 90s, to be based overseas, people not only knew CNN, but you could see the international service. You, of course, could not see the domestic service, but that helped an awful lot in terms of access in trying to get interviews with people or just being familiar. I'll tell you a story about a beloved colleague of mine who died some months ago. Sadly, Richard Blystone, but he was the senior European correspondent, and I was with him at the University of the Western Cape, not a university that I think is terribly well known. It's about an hour or so outside of Cape Town. And we arrived to talk to students. This was when Mandela was on the eve of his election. And our van was no marking, nothing that would indicate television, much less CNN. We had no equipment. We didn't take anything out. He and I just got out, and we saw some students leaning up against the backs of cars, just sort of universal campus hanging out before class. And we were maybe 70 feet approaching them, and one of them yelled out, Richard Blystone, CNN, I saw your reports from Mogadishu. And I just about fainted, and I thought, wow, if that doesn't summarize the power of television, and that was more than a year before. And, they knew the fellow by name, the story that he had covered, and it was thousands of miles away. It wasn't like it was a story in South Africa. So CNN very quickly became impressionable around the world, and that was, you know, a tremendous honor to be part of that.
My guest today is Edith Chapin, the executive editor of NPR News, and she's the guest of Public Radio Tulsa for the Give and Take tonight at 7 at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the University of Tulsa campus. You can get ticket information at publicradiotulsa.org, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, after a decade or more working overseas, you began running bureaus in the United States. You were in New York as managing editor of CNN's bureau on 9/11, and here you'd seen genocides in Africa and in Bosnia. You had seen incredible stories like the election of Mandela in South Africa. You'd seen horrific scenes of natural disasters and man-caused disasters. But here you're covering a scene right in New York City. I believe you alerted the CNN that a plane hit the World Trade Center.
I did. And September 11th, 2001 will stay in my memory for a long time. Certainly, I'm glad I didn't know when I got up that morning what was going to play out. But it was a very busy morning, as it was. And there's a third story, which I don't remember, but it was the New York Republican primary and Rudy Giuliani. And it was Fashion Week. And a third story, which escapes me at the moment. So we had atypically a large number of people out on the street, really surprising for 8:30 in the morning. And I had just spoken on the morning editorial meeting and gone through the various things that we were covering for the day. And two of my colleagues were in an office 180 degrees the other direction facing south, and they saw the plane move through the buildings and impact. And one of them had the presence of mind to pick up the phone and call headquarters, and the other came running into the newsroom. And so I took the conference call off of mute, and I said, "This is New York. We have breaking news. A plane has hit the World Trade Center." And as I said those words, I was really thinking of Corey Lytle, the New York Yankees pitcher, who about a year before had been taking flying lessons, and his plane hit a residential building on the east side of Manhattan and sort of was hanging down the side. And I did not picture a major airliner, but everyone gasped, and you could hear all the pings as the conference call disconnected, and I took three steps into the newsroom, and there was a bank of television screens, and I could see on the WABC helicopter shot that there was a big black strip across the top of one of the towers, and I knew, of course, that was no Cessna. And the author, Amy Tan, was in our newsroom. She was 20 seconds from being interviewed about her new book, and there was a sound-baffling partition on either side of her, and I ripped it out so that I could see across, and she gave me this funny look like, "Who's this crazy person who's just ripped this partition?" But, you know, the day went on, one sort of surprising notion after another, and at one point a colleague said, you know, maybe 30,000 people had died. Of course, fortunately, that was not the case, but I was thinking 30,000 people, that's the vast majority of a crowd at a Yankees game, and just trying to put that number into some kind of context into my head. And when the first tower came down, I will tell you, something very unusual happened in a newsroom. It just went completely quiet. A phone did not ring. Nobody said anything. There were no expletives uttered, also very unusual in a newsroom. And everybody was stunned. I mean, this was about an hour and 15 minutes after, of course, the first plane had hit. And almost everybody there was an experienced news person and either native New Yorker or longtime New Yorker. It had not occurred to anybody that the tower was going to come down. And, of course, then you knew that it was likely the second one was going to come down at some point. But for me, the first thing I did was, we still use pagers in those days. It was before ubiquitous cell phones. I mean, people did have cell phones, but not quite the way we do now. And sent a text page to everybody on staff and said, please respond and say you're okay. And one by one, I would tick them off on a list I had. And there were two people who were not responding. And one of them then responded but didn't sign their name. And so I was like, who are you? And then I knew that there was one person, and just not getting any response and not getting any response. And I kept thinking, oh, I know this person's husband, and I really don't want to have a phone call that's what I think I might have to do. And it felt like an eternity. Maybe it was 20 minutes, and she responded. But she had to take cover hiding behind a cold case in a delicatessen because that dirt ball that we all saw just rushed up the street, and she needed to get out of the way. And no sooner did she then check in, it was, I don't know, 5 or 7 minutes later that, of course, the second tower came down, and we had to do the exercise all over again. And again, she was the last to check in, and you're thinking, well, she's probably moved. And fortunately, she had just been able to get back in behind that frozen case a second time. But it was an extraordinary day and series of weeks, and just something I don't think anybody who was in New York or Washington or Shanksville or frankly anywhere will ever forget.
Yeah, just like when these events happen around the world too.
This one feels, even 17 years later, clearly there are many young people who have no memory or association with it. But I think, you know, it's difficult to make historical comparisons, but clearly my parents' generation and others talked about Pearl Harbor. You never want to, you know, equate everything, but or the Kennedy assassination. I think this is one that a large number of people will talk about for still many years to come, despite everything feeling quicker and faster and ephemeral these days.
Well, after 25 years at CNN, you left CNN to come to NPR.
That must have been, public media.
That must have been a very difficult decision. I mean, you started as an intern, you leave as a vice president.
It was difficult, but not difficult. And I say that with great respect and affection for both organizations. I felt that 25 years was a really nice round time, and I wanted to experience something new and different. And NPR, a fantastic organization, you know, a journalistic entity that I had enormous respect for. And it was an opportunity to come and run the international coverage, which is something that I felt I could really make a contribution on. I'm one of a small number of journalists, surprisingly small, that have covered national and international and Washington, and I think that makes me a much better journalist. A lot of people have done two of the three, but I'm surprised at how few have done all three.
Why is that important?
Because everything is so interconnected, whether it's business or policy or understanding cultures and worlds. It makes you a better journalist to see the comparison. And so coming to NPR was a fantastic opportunity and one I was delighted to do. And so I spent the first 3 years at NPR leading the international coverage. We have an extraordinary set of correspondents around the world in places that a lot of news organizations are not.
That's a rare thing in American-based journalism.
And so that makes it very, very special. And so it was an opportunity to work with new, very talented storytellers, people who had tremendous experience. And so I did that for 3 years, and I would have happily continued to do that. But a colleague then left a little over 3 years ago, and I was asked to take on the role overseeing not just international, but all of our areas, Washington, national, business, science, arts, et cetera. But the international coverage is clearly, as we talked about, based on how I grew up, very near and dear to my heart and something I care deeply about.
My guest today is Edith Chapin, the executive editor of NPR News. You can see her talk tonight. We're going to do another interview on the Give and Take tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the TU campus. And we'll be talking more about just sort of the issues going on in daily journalism today.
There are just a few.
There are just a few. But I want to ask about one today, which is when you're watching national news in America, Washington is just sucking all the oxygen in coverage. I mean, the only thing that gets in is like a tragedy, a natural disaster, you know, these sort of major, often picture-led coverage around the country. One thing I do appreciate about NPR is we're still trying to cover everything around the country and around the world. Can you talk about balancing that decision between this all-consuming Washington coverage and the rest of the world?
Well, one of the reasons I came to NPR is because its original news magazine was and still is called All Things Considered. And how fantastic is that? It is a challenge and everything is squeezed, but NPR's commitment to science coverage, you know, correspondent Rob Stein and what the reporting he's done that's exclusive about gene editing, sometimes it scares the daylights out of me at the morning meeting and I say, gosh, you know, really, But phenomenal stuff, you know, business reporting about Wells Fargo, you know, stories from Puerto Rico, which we've invested a tremendous amount of time and Adrian Florido has done an exemplary job. It is really important, and what NPR is committed to is to, as best it can, and we're all going to disagree on a given day about the mix of stories, but it is our mission and our responsibility to tell the story of America from all across the country. And to do that, we need stations like Tulsa Public Radio to help us because we can't be everywhere, but we need to sound and reflect America in the voices we hear from, in the stories we choose to tell, because yes, you could fill it all up from inside the Beltway, and there are a lot of important things going on in Washington, there are a lot of important things going on in parts of the globe, but we have to have a well-balanced menu. Maybe every day isn't as perfectly balanced as we all might like, but I think of it like the old USDA plate with a little protein and some vegetable and some carbohydrates and a little sweet. And that's what we need to aim for in the aggregate across the week.
I'm glad you mentioned Puerto Rico. I've appreciated that coverage because the world has looked away. You know, even though they say there's full electricity, you can still find people who don't have electricity here a year later. I was going to mention John Burnett's reporting from Guatemala.
Absolutely.
This was a story that, you know, the child separation policy, but now that's being covered in courtrooms, you know, as...
But he went there and he's looking for parents that, you know, the U.S. government is or isn't looking for, but other agencies, the ACLU, to name one, but not the only one, are trying to find parents. And it's important that we're there on the ground. And that's the great privilege of journalism, is that journalists get to go the places everybody doesn't always get to go to. But particularly in radio, it's telling stories, describing scenes so that the consumer, the listener in the case of radio, can make that movie in their head. And if we don't take you there, if we just talk about it in the abstract, it's not nearly as personal, not nearly as interesting, and not nearly as impactful.
Right. Well, we'll have more discussion tonight about this at the Give and Take. And Edith, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Edith Chapin is the executive editor of NPR News. She'll also be the guest for Public Radio Tulsa's Give and Take tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the University of Tulsa campus. For ticket information about the event, visit publicradiotulsa.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.